It's 14 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Last March, Philadelphia became the home for a new Pops orchestra, the Philly Pops, with conductor Peter Nero. Peter Nero is with me now, and he's in Philadelphia for the next Pops performance, which is this Monday night. The program is being called Uptown Downtown, and it will include songs from the musical 42nd Street. The special guest artist will be Vivian Reed, the star of Bubbling Brown Sugar. Peter Nero is a conductor and pianist with jazz, classical, and pop recordings to his credit. His recording of the summer of 42 went gold in 1971. He's received 2 Grammys for his work. He's a very busy man, guest conducting a number of orchestras in addition to leading the new Philly Pops. Peter Nero, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Before becoming a conductor, you were first known as a pianist. What interested you in conducting?
Well, John Williams said something on the air a month ago, and that's kind of my feelings about it. When he was composing in the studios, other conductors were conducting his music, and he said he sort of got into conducting by self-defense. I thought that was an appropriate phrase, and that's exactly what happened to me, because almost everything that I was playing with the symphony orchestras that I was guesting with were my arrangements or compositions. And while we had a lot of very fine conductors there was always a tendency on a Pops night for the conductors to sort of treat it very lightly, which meant that they didn't prepare. So I felt that everything that was going on was really not true to what it should have been.
Exactly what can a conductor do to undermine your work?
Well, probably the lack of preparation is the most serious violation. Not taking it seriously, understanding that there are musical values in there that have to be brought out, and that it takes rehearsal and it takes some thought. It's not just something that plays itself. This is the kind of arrangements that I write. Actually, the kind of arrangements that I write are really traditional in the sense that the players have to play them. It's not the kind of a thing that's going to sound good no matter who's doing it. And that generally was a Pops formula, where the arrangements were done in such a way as they were just, frankly, just simplistic. Not just simple, but simplistic. So, as a matter of fact, it was right here at Ambler, at the Temple University Music Festival one summer, that the conductor hurt his back during rehearsal, and I was sort of forced to take over that night. And it was that night that I decided, after conducting the orchestra, that this is what I was going to do from then on.
Now, that was before you studied conducting, though, right?
Oh, no, I had studied in college and at Juilliard.
What are some of the things you've learned about conducting an orchestra now that you've been doing it for some time?
Well, it's been about 10 years now. Oh, it's been an awful lot. When I look back on those early days when I first conducted, I wonder how I had the nerve to get up there.
What were you doing wrong?
Well, it's not so much a question of doing things wrong. It's not really being experienced. And, of course, that is always the problem in any profession, is that you cannot get the job until you have the experience, but you can't get the experience until you get the job. So in a sense, I was lucky that I fell into it and did get the chance to learn as I was going along. Orchestra is an instrument, and of course you have to play it, but it's not the same as this. That's where the similarity ends. Even though it's an instrument, it's composed of human beings, so each orchestra is different. They all have personalities of their own, and they are going to play in a certain way, and you can change it just so much. So in a sense, you're really there to help them sound as good as their potential is. And this is where the musicianship comes in. I really don't think that there's a great difference in conducting an orchestra and playing an instrument in the approach, because just as you would practice pieces on your own on an instrument, likewise you would rehearse an orchestra in the same way. When I rehearse them, I am listening to them. I'm sort of their ears collectively. And if I hear things in there that I do not think will sound well, then it's my job at that point to correct them. Of course, some people have said that when it comes to interpreting music, tempo is everything. And I do believe that that is very important, because that's what makes a big difference between one conductor and another, is the tempos that he chooses.
If I were to come and watch you conduct in a rehearsal and then came and saw you conduct in a performance, what would some of the differences be in what I was seeing?
Well, I have found that if you don't get it done in the rehearsal, you won't get it at the performance. So the rehearsal becomes most important. And in today's musical world, rehearsal is very short. It is not the kind of a situation that existed many, many years ago, where you just kept on doing it until you got it as best as possible. So now we have to work to get it as best as possible within the limitations of time.
Is that an ironic situation for you to be in, since you got into this in the first place feeling that not enough time was spent preparing on the part of conductors for a performance?
In a sense, there's two ways of looking at it. First of all, I have found, for instance, when I was a soloist rehearsing with other orchestras and other conductors, that even though the orchestra was playing it exceptionally well and had, in my opinion, peaked for the rehearsal, the conductors kept on rehearsing because they had another half hour left. And this is one of the reasons that orchestras are so adamant about rehearsal time staying the way it is. So it does force the conductor to be very economical and not to rehearse just for his own gratification, but just to get it up to that point. There are a lot of conductors who are very popular with orchestras because they know when to stop. They know when to let the orchestra save it for the performance at night. Over-rehearsing can be just as bad as under-rehearsing. So it really means that you have to be very careful in using your time so that you don't dwell on things that are going to be good at night anyway. So you have to know the difference as to what has to be changed in rehearsal and what is going to go well that night, even though it may not sound the greatest, especially when you're dealing with new music. Now, a lot of the things we do are brand new for the orchestra. They've never seen the parts before. Other things are traditional repertoire that they have played all their lives. So there are many concerts that have been done by orchestras with conductors where they haven't rehearsed at all, just simply for the fact that the conductor missed the plane and couldn't get there in time for the rehearsal, and they have gone exceptionally well. And orchestra players who know the repertoire will tell you that they don't have to rehearse it. They know it.
Things like that make you wonder whether the conductor is there more for the audience, more as a frontman or an actor for the audience, or more for the orchestra as a way to shape or to reshape the music that you're going to be hearing.
I think it's definitely a combination of both. But of course, orchestras, when they first started to become orchestras, had no conductors at all. So the conductor was an addition that came about. That's a long story in itself. So it all depends on the conductor's conception of what his role is.
What are some of the things that you do for the sake of the audience?
Nothing. I mean, in terms of looking good up there?
Well, sometimes I think that the more flamboyant a conductor, the more a conductor hams it up, the more the audience is going to really appreciate it and think that they're a great conductor. If you wave your arms a lot.
This is always a problem that the conductor has to consider. Now, there are certain pieces where the conductor can really put an audience to sleep. And one of them, for instance, is Ravel's Bolero, where his job is just to keep time and to keep the dynamics correct. And, of course, to me, that one, not only the dynamics, but the tempo in that one is the most important thing, because it does have a tendency to go up and down, and you have to figure out where it's sagging, where it's pushing ahead, and how to think of the thing cohesively. That's an interesting piece, because it is the same theme 8 times repeated with varied orchestration, so it must build. But I have found, especially with Ravel's Bolero, but in general, I've found that every performance is different every night. So it all depends on how it is going, and it's my job at that point to conceive of the thing in terms of the space of time and to say, okay, now it is beginning to need something at this point, so I'll push it. The night before, I might have just let it go or even held it back for that matter. But it is difficult for the audience at that point because the conductor doesn't have that much to do in throwing cues and so forth or to look physical. So in cases like that, if it will help the audience feel the music more, yes, I will do something that will be considered visual and not really essential to the music. But 99% of the time, I think most conductors will tell you this, if they are sincere about the music, is that whatever they're doing up there is to help the musicians.
Is most of what you're doing there for the musicians giving them cues, or do you feel like you also have to be doing something that is going to help inspire them or push them? Or is there anything you could do at that point to get a better performance of individuals?
Whatever has to be done, I will do. And that just is a question of trial and error, depending on which orchestra you're conducting. If it's your own orchestra, they know you well enough, so they know what to expect of you. And I know what they want of me, I can tell. You get with as a guest conductor with other orchestras, you can do a dance up there. It doesn't make a difference. It all depends on who their own conductor is and how they've been trained. There are conductors who are just hardly move at all. And the orchestra, I think Fritz Reiner was famous for that, where if he raised his little finger, that was fortissimo. And if he raised a little less, that was mezzo forte and so forth. So his motions were very within a small area. So it all depends on what the orchestra needs. It's as simple as that. If I feel like they're not getting enough of an accent in there, and I've told them in rehearsal and it hasn't happened on the performance, the next time we come to that accent, let's say 2 bars later, I will turn around to them and really glare or dig in or make exaggerated motions for that moment until I get what I think should be.
How can you practice or rehearse as a conductor?
In front of a mirror, usually. I always like to see how the orchestra sees me. And I always picture what it would be like to sit in the orchestra, and if I was looking at the conductor, would it be clear? Well, what I would like and what they would like, I have to find that difference in there. And, of course, every player is different, so, again, you have to gauge. There are some players that just, all they want to know is where, just tell me where one is, and I'll go from there. And there are others who like to be cued, and others who don't like to be cued. So again, it's a question of just finding out as you go along. The most difficult thing is to be a guest conductor because you're conducting somebody else's orchestra, and the orchestra has a way of playing, and especially when you're doing traditional repertoire. And I had a conversation, it was just last summer, we did excerpts from the Carmen Suite, and it was with one of the symphonies down south, a very good one, and I've played with them maybe 20 times, and we did this piece for the first time, for me. In other words, my first time conducting them in this piece. And we have limited rehearsal time, and we ran through it, and to me it was not what I wanted. And I went back over certain spots to see if I could get them to get the idea. And the performance was much closer to what I wanted, but still not there. And I spoke to the concertmaster, and I asked him, I said, what is lacking? And he says, you have to understand, we've played this piece hundreds of times. And he says, we've played it in the same way, and we sort of locked into this way of playing it. And it's very difficult for us to start to change now. So he says, we do the best we can for you, but that's as good as we can do. Mm. Now, this is going to happen with anybody. And I don't know if a conductor will tell you this, but that's as simple as it is.
All right. Peter Nero is my guest, if you're just joining us, and he's in town for the next performance of the Philly Pops, which is this Monday evening. The performance is being called Uptown Downtown, and it's going to feature guest performer Vivian Reed, who you may know from Bubbling Brown Sugar. The Boston Pops is the oldest Pops orchestra in the country. How do you think the Philly Pops compares and differs with the Boston Pops?
Well, the Boston Pops is basically Boston Symphony Orchestra players without the principals. We are a separate entity. The orchestra is composed of members of a group in Philadelphia called the Concerto Soloists, plus people from, as a matter of fact, these same people, too, play for the ballet and for the opera, and we have a lot of Curtis people in there. So we have a nice balance of experience and youth, so we get what I like to call exuberance. What it really boils down to is an orchestra that wants to play, an orchestra that's not jaded, an orchestra that's excited about what's going on. Plus the fact that the kind of music we're playing is so varied that it is very challenging for them. They have to change gears very quickly. We don't divide the program as Boston does into two halves. Traditionally, what Arthur Fiedler used to do is do the classical portion in the first half and the pop in the second. We mix it up throughout the concert.
How come?
Well, my reasoning is that these labels are man-made, and there's nothing that says that you can't do it. If somebody asked me, why do you do this? And the only answer I could say is, why not? I mean, who says it has to be otherwise? I feel that if we can tear down these labels and take the music for what it is, first of all, we are bringing music to people who normally have it removed from them, kind of on a pedestal. It's kind of an elitist kind of attitude that has been perpetuated throughout the centuries, really. That this kind of music is for certain people and not for others. And this to me is false because there is value in that music and substance there for these people to grab onto. And for instance, some of the things that we are doing in the classical repertoire, the people know the melodies, but they do not know them to identify them. So if we are going to do the third movement of the Rachmaninoff Second Symphony, that will scare a lot of people away. But if I explain to them that two pop songs were taken from this, one was I Can't Get Started With You about 40 years ago, and more recently a song called Never Going to Fall in Love Again by Eric Carmen, who was a music student out of Cleveland. Then suddenly they realize that this is not so far removed from them, and I enjoy presenting it to them in its original form. So this way, in mixing it up, I'm showing them that music is music, and it really doesn't matter whether it's called rock or jazz. Pop to me is just a catch-all term. All it means is that we are, to me it means freedom to do whatever we feel like doing and whatever I think the audience will like.
Well, how do you choose the repertoire? How do you put together a show? Most of the shows so far have been thematic. There's some umbrella under which the repertoire is organized.
Yeah, they've been thematic, but with leaving a lot of room. One show is called From Broadway to Hollywood. Okay, well, that leaves me, so I'm wide open. For the Hollywood things, I was able to do classical things that have been used as background scores for most motion pictures. So we did pictures at an exhibition, and there, and that's been used to death. Everything else has, too. So it was just a simple matter of taking things that I thought in the classical repertoire that the audience would enjoy. And we backed that up, I think, with The Wiz, because that was from Broadway. And by the way, the pop arrangements that we have are different also in terms of Boston, in that they have a formula that has worked over the years, and they've kept it.
What's that formula?
Music that doesn't get in anybody's way, doesn't hurt anybody, so that The Wiz is going to sound like Rodgers and Hammerstein, or Rodgers and Hammerstein will sound like the next pop tune and so forth. And it's a kind of writing and approach that is fine and works for the people of Boston and so forth. They are fulfilling that role for people. I feel there's no point in us doing the same thing, and I never have. So what I do is take the same serious approach to pop music as we do to classical music. So in other words, if we're going to play The Wiz, the arrangement is going to sound like rock and roll or disco. That's what it's going to sound like. That's what it should be. And it's just as if you're being true to the composer or to the original format of it.
Now, how do you take a rock and roll tune, which people basically associate with the record, which may have a couple of guitars, a bass, drums, maybe a lead singer, and translate that into an orchestral arrangement and still preserve
the
integrity?
How do we do it with great difficulty? It all depends on the original. For instance, The Wiz that I was referring to before, it took three songs from that, all of which I felt had good melodic content. So when you're dealing with a good melody, then it's simple to present it instrumentally. Working with something like Saturday Night Fever, which I did an arrangement of 14 minutes of Saturday Night Fever, on that one I felt that the recording was so strong and that the style and the production of the recording was so unique that I try to capture that rather than just take the songs and do something different with them. So that was a tough one, and on that one I had to use guitar. That's the only time I've ever used guitar for any of our concerts. So I try to stay away from using anything unconventional. None of the arrangements that I write have saxophones in them either. So in other words, we don't have to bring in a band. So it still is a symphony orchestra that can be a band, that can be flexible enough. And of course, that how to make that sound like what it should requires a different style of writing. There are plenty of writers around the country that can do this kind of thing, but they are not asked to do it. In other words, the symphonies are saying, hold back because we want this to be bland. We want this to be, don't get in anybody's way. I call it elevator music, and I really consciously try to stay away from it.
Another significant difference between the way a rock or a jazz recording is going to sound and what you're going to hear in an orchestra is the drumming. There's very different kinds of drumming, I think, that you'll find in both places. How do you work with the rhythm or the rhythm section?
I have a rhythm section that is always with me. It's the same rhythm section that I take with me around the country on all my symphony guest dates and also the trio concert dates that we do, where I am just a pianist and not a conductor. And they sit right up front. They are not buried in the percussion section. In other words, the bass player is not off in a corner somewhere. So they are a very important part of what goes on. In a sense, it's like a band in that case. But it goes much deeper than that because they are not playing all the time. It's not a drone. They are in and out, but when they are there, their presence is felt, and they provide the rhythmic coloring that is necessary to be true to the style in which we're writing.
I think people who look down at pop's orchestras feel that pop's orchestras try to make music more palatable, and in doing that, things are smoothed out, things are made sweeter, and that some of the integrity of the music is lost. React to that.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, you're positively right. But the only people that feel that way are those who really don't know. I think the general public that comes in doesn't feel that way at all. The general public has much more open mind, and they are the ones that are really willing to accept an awful lot, especially if it's presented to them in a palatable way, not the music, but the approach to it.
No, what's in the approach?
Well, let's see if I can explain this correctly. You really have to be there to... Well, first of all, as I had mentioned before, the fact that we mix it up. That is now placing the music right in their laps and saying, okay, here, I'm going to give you Saturday Night Fever, and I'm also giving you Beethoven's Ninth, which we did at our May concerts. We did the last movement of the Beethoven Ninth with full chorus and soloists. And the performance of that, I was so proud of that one because they were really super. The performers were just marvelous, and the performance, the end result, was as good as any major symphony orchestra in the country. The point is the players are capable of that. This is where their roots are. So what we are really developing is an orchestra that can do both, that can play authentic pops. Now, I don't mean pop, but authentic popular music, as we had just described before. And at the same time, when they play anything in the traditional repertoire, it will sound correct and it will sound exciting. So we really can do both. And in that sense, we are unique because we are not splitting the difference. As you might hear a pops orchestra, or I should say a pops orchestra, a symphony orchestra on a pops night, what they will do is they will play pop music. It'll be nice, and they will play semi-classical, or that term which I hate, or light classical, which I also hate, but that's what most people understand, and that will sound nice also. We try to get away from that. We try to make everything sound as it should. In other words, exciting.
Do you have to listen to the radio or go to... go to diners and listen to jukeboxes a lot to see what's in the air, what people are hearing, what's really popular and getting played a lot?
No. Isn't that much around now that's taking over everything. It's really becoming a smaller segment of the population now that is responsible for the top 40 recordings. And there are certain things in the top 40 recordings that I feel that are just not meant for us. They're not meant for our audiences. They're not meant for us to play. That even if we play them, those people that like those records wouldn't come to hear us do it anyway. So if I find something that is of redeeming value in the charts, I will take that and present it. But there is very little, because most of the recordings that come out in truth and in substance are very thin. Melodically, it's monotonous, repetitious, sounds like what just came out before it. Harmonically, it's boring. And since we're not concerned with the lyrics in this case, we can't pass judgment on that. The productions, the recordings themselves, are very sophisticated and very complicated, which can never be reproduced on a concert stage. So that is why it is difficult. Most of the music that seems to be coming out that is melodic is coming from some of the Broadway shows, like the Hamlish things or what Vivian Reed is going to be doing. 42nd Street, the songs from that show were all written by Harry Warren, and they're all in the 1930s. So we're going back now to the 30s.
But that's mostly where you look for the popular repertoire to the stage.
Well, there are no boundaries. Whatever has got it musically will be presented, regardless of where it comes from. What I'm saying is that there is very little coming in the top 40s on the charts. And it, part of to substantiate that is very simple. The songs that are on the top 40 charts are up and they're down and out. You never hear them again.
Do you feel like you're in competition at all with the Philadelphia Orchestra?
No, not at all.
Why not?
Because we don't do what they do, and they don't do what we do. By the way, before we got this started, we got their blessing on it. When this was discussed, which was back last year during the summer, and our first concerts, by the way, were November of last year, and when it was in the discussion stage, Mosepti, who was our impresario, went to the Philadelphia Orchestra and said, I would like to do a pop series. And they said, we just don't have the time. We haven't done a pops concert since 1976. And it was ironic because in 76, I was the one that had done it with them. So they gave Mo their blessing and said, please go ahead because you can fulfill a need for the community that we just don't have the time to do.
So you probably also have a different kind of audience than the orchestra, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. We have an audience that wants to hear a pops concert. By the same token, there are some crossovers there. But I feel that what we are presenting there will not only keep our audiences happy, but at the same time send some of them to the Philadelphia Orchestra, because they'll be hearing pieces that the Philadelphia Orchestra plays, and they normally would not have gone to a Philadelphia Orchestra or any symphony orchestra concert.
Peter Nero is my guest, if you're just joining us, and we're talking about the Philly Pops, which he will be conducting again this Monday night in a performance that they're calling Uptown Downtown, and the guest is going to be Vivian Reed of Bubbling Brown Sugar. Now, through all of this traveling that you're doing, guest conducting across the country, leading the Philly Pops, you're also keeping up your work as a pianist. What kind of practicing do you have to maintain in your schedule as you're jetting around?
Well, most of it is just simply to stay in shape. So I do that at home before I leave. And once I start performing, it just takes warm-up before that. It's the open days where I don't have to play that I have to go practice. So I find a piano at the Academy or at Curtis, and I'll do about an hour, of just again, just to stay in shape.
Can you ever get a piano moved into a hotel room?
Yes, I've had that done if I stay for a period of time. But I'm pretty close to the Academy, so there really isn't too much of a problem.
Right, I've always wondered what that would be like.
I've had
that. I need one, I'll tell you.
I've had that, but I tell you, it would have to be a piano that is equivalent to what I'm playing on stage. Otherwise, the actions are usually so light that it just doesn't give you any kind of a fight, and I might as well just warm up on a desk.
Could you tell us what's going to be happening on the program Monday night?
Sure. We are going to, I won't tell you what the first thing is, because that's a little bit of a surprise. The second thing will be a tribute to Richard Rodgers. This is something that I wrote. I was commissioned to write it for the Chautauqua Festival in New York in August. And it's 20 minutes of Richard Rodgers songs. There are 12 songs presented in their entirety, and another 24 themes worked in, so that it's not just a medley. It becomes more of a sort of a montage of his work. Then that's for piano and orchestra with a rhythm section. And following that, Vivian Reed will do about 20 minutes, which she'll be singing songs from Bubbling Brown Sugar and a few other things. And from what I've heard of the recording, she really is a super singer. Then after that, so that'll close the first half. The second half, it will not close the first half. We're going to insert in there the Rachmaninoff movement that I mentioned to you before. Especially since I can't get started from you, can't get started with you comes from, I still have jet lag, by the way, comes from that era in the 30s. And again, it gives me a good chance to play a piece that I think the audience will like and that I love. The second half will start off with the last movement of the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony. It has nothing to do with 1930 whatsoever. And I'll probably find a good excuse to fit it into the concept of uptown, downtown, because maybe he lived in uptown Moscow or downtown Stalingrad. I don't know. But of course, it wasn't Stalingrad then. But I like to play it, and I think the audience will enjoy it. So we will do it. Vivian Reed will return, and then after that, we will do 5 songs from 42nd Street.
With Vivian Reed?
No. This will be strictly instrumental. However, on this one, we have 3 different arrangers, and they were written specially for this concert. So we're going to get some variety in there. And I wrote one of the arrangements. Bill Holcomb has written 2. Don Rose, who wrote an album for the Buffalo Philharmonic, which was called Gershwin on Broadway, has done 1. And a gentleman who plays with our orchestra, name is Lou DeLeese, is writing 1. See, I am trying to encourage members of the orchestra who have written things before to write for us, because I think they have a good grasp of what we're out for. So I think we'll get a nice variety there of, it's just as if we're going to be playing 3 different composers. So the approach will be different on each one.
Okay, well, this program is coming up Monday evening, and again, the program's being called Uptown, Downtown.
And Sunday afternoon.
Oh, and Sunday afternoon too. Okay, good. Well, ironically, we're going to hear a record now of you playing with the Boston Pops, the aforementioned Boston Pops. We'll be hearing the last movement of Gershwin's Concerto in F. Do you want to say anything about the experience of recording this before we hear it?
Well, the way these recordings were made, because I did 2 albums with them, and what you do is you play 2 concerts of the same music with the orchestra. And that, of course, has 2 rehearsals in front. And then when the concerts are over, we record the entire album in 1 session in 3 hours. 3 microphones are hung from the ceiling at Orchestra Hall. The orchestra is seated on the floor rather than on the stage. And we play everything essentially once. And then maybe a few spots, and those things are inserted. But there's very little to be done in mixing afterwards and in editing. And that performance, I think, was recorded in 1965, I believe. It's about 15 years ago. I've mellowed a bit since then, and don't play it quite as fast. But somebody once remarked that the tempo of the last movement indicates that possibly the orchestra was double parked during the record session. Anyway, tempo is a matter of taste.
Okay, well, before we hear this, I just want to ask you one final thing, Peter Nero. What are your goals with the Philly Pops? What would you like to see the orchestra become?
I would like to see it become, or rather continue to be as unique as it is now, and to continue to be as versatile as possible, and possibly to be the basis of what a lot of orchestras in the country should be able to do, not become, but do. To be proficient playing all kinds of music and to kind of lend a legitimacy to what has been referred to as pops, which, as you had said earlier in the interview, tends to have a connotation of being insignificant. We are trying to make it as significant, and this, of course, will be reflected in the writing and in the performance.
Okay, well, Peter Nero, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this afternoon.
Thanks
very much for being here.
Thank you.
Peter Nero is the conductor of the Philly Pops, who has performances this Sunday and Sunday afternoon and Monday evening. Again, the program is called Uptown Downtown. The guest artist is singer Vivian Reed, who's well known for her work in Bubbling Brown Sugar. Well, onwards to the aforementioned recording. This is Peter Nero as the piano soloist with the Boston Pops under the direction of the late Arthur Fiedler. This is the last movement of Gershwin's Concerto in F.
Thank you.
Peter Nero, the piano soloist with the Boston Pops, conducted by the late Arthur Fiedler. We heard the last movement of George Gershwin's Concerto in F. It's 24 minutes after 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Bill Van Wert will be with us in just a few minutes to review a new film and to highlight some of the movies coming up this week on television. Right now we're going to hear a short interview with Jean-Pierre Rampal, a flutist who has become very popular among classical music listeners, as well as many jazz listeners. He received a lot of popular recognition after recording Claude Bolling's Suite for Flute and Jazz Piano. He recently spoke with Heather Dembert for the NPR Morning Edition program, and she asked him what the difference was in his classical and jazz playing.
First, I don't play jazz. It's a work written for classical flutist with a jazz piano trio, it's all. Then I don't think it requires more adjustment than when you play a Telemann or Vivaldi work, and when you play a Mozart, or when you don't play the same, or when you play a Stravinsky or Debussy. It's not the same style. Then you have to adjust, you know, to try to adjust. It's not good if when you hear an artist, it's always the same artist, you know. Of course, you must have a personality, but if you must have your personality following the personality of the composer, which is very important. When I improvise, I improvise only on Baroque music, because you have to improvise the ornaments or cadences. But otherwise, I'm not an improvisateur. Yes. I'm not a jazz player. When you play with the orchestra, you are making a sort of collectivity of musicians, you know. You share the love you have for music with many people, much more than with a partner. But still, it's the same. You have to project a little more, so you have to play a little more different because you play with the orchestra.
I just also was thinking, I've heard it said that when you play the flute, you're able to beautifully translate what you hear in your mind through the flute. So I was wondering, when you hear the record, the recordings of your music, if it sounds a lot differently than it does in your own mind.
Well, it cannot sound exactly the same. Like you know, when you play the music, it's a reflection of one moment, and this moment is lost after you have played. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Unless every concert you give are recorded, then you have a record of that. You know, I mean, you can still listen again, but otherwise it's lost. It's lost. And every interpretation, anyway, myself for me, you know, I'm not the sort of artist who plays always the same thing, you know, and very very correctly. You know, there is a lot of artists. They are so. Their temperament is so adjustable to the music that they know that they will play perfectly, and there is no surprise. And great interpreter, very good. Anyway, I'm a little different. I'm like many of the others who are susceptible, you know, sensitive to the fact that the public is this public, the other public is different, and so, then I never play the same.
Does it sound differently to you when you hear it?
When you are in the studio and when you play on
when you hear a
in front of the public,
the way it sounds
it's the
in
same
your mind.
Because when you record in the studio, you are never by yourself. I remember for all these sessions I had with John Steele Ritter, my partner, we had a public. In fact, you know, we had few friends, you know, in the cabin. I mean, the control room, and plus the engineer, the producer. You know, it's a public. It's not so different to have a public consisting in 6 or 7 persons and a public with 6,000 people. When you play in front of the public, you play for all the public. You don't play for each person separately. You play for the public, you know, which is an entity. You know? And when you play in a studio, you play in a small room, you play for few people, but it's the same reason.
That was Jean-Pierre Rampal speaking with Heather Dembert about his playing. Their interview was recorded for the NPR Morning Edition program, which is produced with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from the German Marshall Fund for International News Coverage. We feature Morning Edition every weekday morning between 6 and 8 o'clock here on WUHY. Well, Bill Van Wert will be with us in just a few minutes to review the film Rockers, which is a film about Jamaica and about reggae music. So that'll be coming up in just about 5 minutes. This is Duke Ellington and his orchestra, a piece by Ellington called Black Butterfly.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington and his orchestra. It's 26 minutes to 4 o'clock. In just a moment, Bill Van Wert will be reviewing the new film Rockers, which is about Jamaica, Rastafarians, and about reggae. So before we hear from Bill, let's just hear an excerpt of a reggae recording. And I know that some of you might not be familiar with reggae music. This is the kind of rhythm that it has, and this is Burning Spear, which is one of the very popular reggae groups.
I'm ready.
Hey, man, why are you coming? Say, Daddy, come, man. Let's move along, man. Roll it.
I'm going.
We're listening to People Get Ready, performed by the reggae group Burning Spear, one of the groups featured in a new film called Rockers. And Fresh Air's film reviewer Bill Van Wert is with me now with a review of Rockers. Welcome back, Bill.
Thank you. Rockers apparently is the updated title given to reggae music. And I should say at the outset that I did not see Jimmy Cliff's Harder They Come, which has become a cult film. I mean, plays in the repertory theaters. It's a midnight show at TLA a lot, and I think Rockers is destined to be the same. And I don't know that much about Rastafarianism. I know that it's a religious sect and that it follows Haile Selassie, and he's called the Lion of Judah. And much of the music reflects religious worship as a kind of context for poverty and political woes. And I'll get into that in a minute about the music. But I want to say at the outset that I'm a tourist in such a film. And I found it very refreshing because I'd not seen anything quite like it. Very briefly, I'm going to tell the plot because the plot is a pretext. There's nothing else going on. I mean, everything is in the music and some fine-tuned jokes. The plot is what I would call a Jamaican version of The Sting. The protagonist, whose name is the actor's name, Leroy Horsemouth Wallace, is a reggae drummer, has his bike stolen by the mafia, and the mafia boss turns out to be the father of his love interest in the film, not his wife, but a woman he loves, is his daughter, and the daughter helps him, and they steal everything in the mafia warehouse and eventually give it all away. I mean, the film ends with all of these stolen television sets and stereos and bikes and all of the material goods apparently on on the island, just lining up the streets, and all the poor people get to be thieves for a change. They all come out in the morning, and it's this hilarious disappearing scene of all the goods coming off the street and going back into the houses. And so I think this is where some critics have called it a Jamaican Robin Hood fairy tale, that Horsemouth doesn't just go for revenge, he gives it back to the people. I think that's the political statement there. It's difficult for a tourist like myself to think too politically in a film like this, since a lot of the religious discussions, a lot of the intoning of Haile Selassie and talking about God is done in the context of this, you know, wondrous, bubbly music, and also in the context visually of smoking joints. And it was something of an event for me in the theater, which is why I think it becomes a cult film, to be sitting there as Horsemouth would light up a joint, so too would the air in the theater be permeated with it. So I mention that for people, you know, with families, that, I mean, this is a cultural phenomenon film you might not want to go into. There's no nudity in the film. The violence, it's apparently less violent than Harder They Come. But the violence in the film produces instant laughter and applause from the audience. And the audience I'm referring to are people from the culture, Rastafarians in Philadelphia. They clap, they laugh, and people get kicked and knocked around in alleys. And it seems like almost like silent film violence, the way Laurel and Hardy would, you know, slap around, or the Three Stooges would knock noses and so on. What I found myself being carried away with, besides the music, was the language. And the language of the film is subtitled throughout, and the subtitles, interestingly, are, you know, one-to-one what they're saying. It's English being subtitled. And so what I found myself doing was reading the subtitles as fast as I could, and then watching the mouths and trying to see, you know, how it would sound coming out that way. And yes, you do need the subtitles. Some of the language, I'll give you a couple examples. When they steal his bike, Horsemouth goes to his friends and says, "Them thief I men bike." And there's a reversal of the pronoun, the I pronoun with me. I seems to be a much more formal, more important one. Me seems to be a more humble pronoun. When referring to another person, they don't say you, they say I. Would the I come with I to find bike? That kind of thing. There are a couple fascinating takeoffs of things that we have in our English, in this culture. When we say, "Do you see?" In the movie, they say sight or seen. And tacking on things like Rasta, brethren, and various words that seem to be in the culture. My favorite for see you soon or see you later, that Horsemouth says dread out. That's D-R-E-A-D, dread out. And everything else seems to have a political tone, but again, for a tourist like myself, is very difficult to pick up on the seriousness of it. Jack Ruby is a character in the film, a Jamaican character, who's just cut a new LP, Free Rhodesia or Else. And another singer in the film, you were in the record studio listening to him basically sing the Bible, "Seek ye good and not evil." And there is either this religious tone to it, or the reggae words, the lyrics, have to do with poverty, capitalism, exploitation, and it many ways does not come across in this bubbling, it makes you want to dance, this music. And so it's a little difficult to take it too seriously if you're not attuned to that culture. There are a couple nice musical in-jokes that have to do with culture. At one point, there are some white tourists in a club, and they're listening to rockers music, and the one says to the other one, "Hey man, I don't think that's Calypso. I think we're in the wrong place." And at another point, Horsemouth and his friend, whose name is Dirty Harry in the film, go into a discotheque, and the film does show nicely the various levels of black Jamaican culture. And apparently the more moneyed the culture is, the more imitative it is of American culture. So they go into this discotheque, and of course the music is American soul music, it's Motown. And Dirty Harry goes into the disc jockey's booth and basically knocks him silly to the floor and locks the booth and plays rockers music. And he announces over the loudspeaker system that this is a takeover. I mean, what's being played out is a revolutionary action for native music over imported soul music, black versus black, to someone outside of the culture. So it's an interesting film. The plot doesn't seem to go anywhere beyond you know, the individual situation of Horsemouth Wallace, who seems to act very well. The best actors in the film are the two women, his wife and the daughter of the mafia boss, played by Monica Malyukre and Marjorie Norman. But it's a little bit like watching The Sting. You're fascinated with, you know, the scam, with pulling off robbing the robbers. And I guess the fairy tale of Robin Hood is nice. What I wanted to see, I guess, once I started to really understand the lyrics of some of the songs, is something a little bit with a little bit more bite to it, something that would reflect more that poverty and that exploitation and some of the anger that's in the music. And I had heard reggae music and never really heard the anger before. And in a sense, it all becomes a kind of camp exercise. You know, where people laugh, and so he's robbed, he sits down and smokes a joint and sings some more reggae tunes. And you know, I've been in foreign cultures where the response is not, you know, direct anger, that there are these outlets, so I can appreciate the difference. But the music is there, and it's one of those films, if you can call the film a musical. If you think of American musicals, it's one of those films where the real content is in the lyrics to the song, not in the plot. And American musicals almost always do the reverse, where the lyrics to the song are basically your comic relief or your respite from reality. Here, no, the real thing is in the music, and the plot is entertainment. It's for you to sit back and smell the smoke and listen to the... It makes you want to dance. I came out feeling like I wanted to dance.
Do you remember where the director's from? I recall reading that he's
His name's Narizano, and he's Italian or Portuguese. He's not a Rastafarian. I'm getting my information from a newspaper article. I don't know this firsthand. But he apparently went to Jamaica and became fascinated with the culture. And hooked on to Horsemouth Wallace, and, you know, they built this thing up. And it'll be a cult film. I mean, it will eventually do well kind of on the late-night repertory circuit.
Okay, well, the film is Rockers. It's playing in Center City. And
I should say also, I mean, it's interesting for a new movie that you know, as it comes out, is going to be a cult film, that the theater was almost three-quarters empty. And I think some of it is, you know, I mean, there's a safety factor or something. Some people think it won't be safe to go in and see it or something, you know, because Jamaica has this reputation for being violent now to Americans. But it's perfectly safe in the theater, I should tell people.
Well, I went to see The movie based on Chaucer, what's it called?
Canterbury Tales.
Thank you. Yes, Canterbury. And that was pretty empty too. So mm-hmm. There's lots of pretty empty movie theaters around town. Mm-hmm. So, okay, this film is called Rockers. And what's on TV this week, Bill?
Lots of good stuff and good variety to it too. On Saturday at 2:30 p.m. on Channel 10, it played once last year and I plugged it. It's the funniest Western I've ever seen, called Evil Roy Slade, with John Astin and Dick Shawn in it. And it plays upon all of the codes of the Western, including the Eastern blonde school marm telling the gunfighter, come east with me where it's civilized, and he does, and goes to a shoe store and shoots people in the shoe store and so on. And it's really funny. I really liked it. At 11:30 p.m. on Saturday on Channel 6, one of the nicest films, it's not nice in content, but one of the real surprises for me, I saw it last year for the first time, The Yakuza with Robert Mitchum. And when it played commercially, I didn't go see it because it sounded like just a lot of violence and a kind of an exploitation of karate and kung fu films and so on. But this one's a real moody piece. I can't even tell you the plot, but it's full of surprises that have to do with relationships changing. What looked to be someone's, you know, love affair was really the other person's daughter, was really lots of family changes. And a real hard adherence to code in terms of Japanese culture. I may be going out on a limb and saying this, but I think you learn as much, if not more, about Japanese culture from a film like The Yakuza than you do from watching Shogun all week.
Who directed it?
I don't know the director. It's Robert Mitchum and Brian Keith and a whole series of Japanese cast. I don't remember the director, but it's got beautiful photography and really interesting kind of flashback structures. And Mitchum is at his moodiest. And he's a perfect person to play someone 20 years after World War II ended. I mean, he has the face for someone who's survived something like that. And it's nice in the men-to-men scenes, and it's nice in the men and women scenes. And there aren't many films that do both that way. On Sunday, Tunes of Glory, 10 a.m. on Channel 12 with Alec Guinness. On Sunday night, you have a choice of three films. They're at different times, so you could see almost all of all three. The Boys from Brazil is on 9 p.m. on Channel 3. Rosemary's Baby, for anyone out there who possibly might not have seen it, started a whole genre of devil scare movies. That's 11:45 on Channel 10, Roman Polanski's film. And my best bet for the evening, 1:30 in the morning on Channel 6, I Confess, is Montgomery Clift plays a priest accused of murder in an Alfred Hitchcock film and is taken to trial. And I think Montgomery Clift is one of the finest actors who ever was, and so I don't like to miss anything he's in. On Monday night, Playing for Time begins at 8 p.m. on Channel 10. I don't think I need to say much about that. It's in Newsweek and everywhere.
I want to say something about that. Okay. That is that Fanya Fenelon, whose life the movie is based on, stopped by on Fresh Air a few months ago. And we'll be rebroadcasting an excerpt of her interview Monday afternoon on Fresh Air. So if you wanted to hear her point of view,
good.
We'll be featuring that Monday afternoon.
That's good. 12:40 in the morning then, Nicholas Rogue's Don't Look Now with Julie Christie is on.
I've heard some wonderful things about that film, though I've never gotten to see it.
Yeah. It would be interesting for people out there, if you see Rosemary's Baby, to see Don't Look Now, because it does have to do with mothering and babies. It has to do with possession. And this time it's more diffuse. It's not the devil, it's spirits, and it's in Venice. And so the locale's very beautiful. On Wednesday night, classic sort of tough film noir film, 8 p.m. on Channel 29, Requiem for Heavyweight with Anthony Quinn. And an interesting film that I've been wanting to see for a long time and have never seen and know a lot about, The Eyes of Laura Mars is playing 9 p.m. on Channel 3 on Wednesday night. That's with Faye Dunaway, and lots of symbolism with taking images and cameras and so on. On Thursday night, The Tall Blonde Man with One Black Shoe, Channel 12 at 9:30 p.m., nice comedy with Pierre Richard. And for classic drama in an American sense, how acting used to predominate films, at 2 in the morning on Channel 3, The Best Man with Henry Fonda and Cliff Robertson. And on Friday night, Friday nights are usually wonderful nights. I mean, they have sort of soap opera fare with The Way We Were and Doctor's Wives, but they're also doing Saturday morning fare for some reason next Friday night with Dracula's Daughter, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil, and some Dr. Shock specials. So it's an interesting and varied week.
Okay, well, Bill, we'll see you next week here on Fresh Air. Bill Van Wert joins us every Friday at about 3:30 to talk about upcoming movies on television and to review a new film. Well, in just about 3 minutes on Fresh Air, we'll be hearing a special program produced for National Public Radio called New Eurekans, and it's a